just tell her.
Okay, I think that was way more interesting than what I'm going to talk about. So I'd encourage anybody who's considering a presentation, we have two more classes yet, so just let me know, like 10 minutes ahead, even. Okay, we were talking about DNA shuffling, but we were really talking about a little more than DNA shuffling. I was going through about five or so examples of interesting uses of the DNA shuffling towards the end of producing new, novel proteins in the test tube, so to speak. And the kinetic shuffling was one step in that, but there was also mutagenesis going on. So I only got through the first example, which was shuffling interferon genes, remember, and getting human genes to create an interferon that was very active in mouse cells. One major use of the DNA shuffling is to produce new antibodies, starting with old antibodies, and mutating, as we saw earlier, mutating the hypervariable regions and making a phage display library, but now introducing DNA shuffling into that mix to produce even tighter binding antibodies. Tighter binding than what? Well, than the best antibody that a body has ever made. And what is that? Is there a limit? Do you see a limit? You do see a limit. The limit's about 10 to the minus 10th molar KD. Why is that? A very interesting old paper, not so old, 95, right? Which is in which this argument is made about a ceiling on the affinity. That is, what's the lowest KD you can get that your immune system would produce? And it's all tied to these, unfortunately, these proportionality symbols should be down here in this equation. So you'll have to move them down with your eyes. So a KD is equal to the off time divided by the on time. So it's a dissociation. So it's off time on the numerator. And the off time is the half-life of how long it stays on. And the on time is the half-life of getting to saturation. Now, because the antigen, the antibody-producing cells, the first ones, the T cells, are displaying this antibody on its surface, as we just heard, and they are being picked out to mature and grow based on the presence of an antigen. So they're displaying it, and it's anchored to their cell surface. Now, a lot of the proteins that are anchored to the cell surface are endocytosed regularly. It could be just 15 minutes. As little as 15 minutes lifetime on the surface, and then they get pinched in and reprocessed, and some new ones come out. Right? So about the longest an antibody would stay on a T cell, according to these guys, is about 3 hours. So that's 10,000 seconds, roughly. Right? So that, any kind of off time, it wouldn't matter if the off time were longer than 3 hours, if it were 3 days instead of 3 hours, because the antibody isn't there anymore more than 3 hours. You can also put an upper limit on the on rate, which is just the diffusion rate of molecules in solution of this molecular weight, roughly. Right. And that has a number of 10 to the sixth for an on rate. That's the fastest that you can get two bodies to macromolecules to collide. Be a million per moles per second. Right? So if you take these two limits, the fastest that you can get on and the longest you could stay on, right, or the slowest you could get off, then that's what gives you this number of 10 to the minus 10. You just take the off rate over the on rate. It's a little more complicated. I put these in red and green to sort of follow things around. But given the numbers that were derived up here, they're put into this final equation to give you 10 to the minus 10. Right? So on the other hand, we know macromolecules are able to bind things with much better than 10 to the minus 10. Look at avidin biotin, which is one of the more extreme examples, but that's more like 10 to the minus 14. So even DHFR can bind its substrate at methotrexate, for instance, at about 10 to the minus 14th if it has the right conditions. So this Wittrup lab that we met before, who was using the yeast display system, adopted the DNA shuffling as an additional mutagenic step in their selection procedure. So they stuck with the yeast cells, they used the FACS, and they just chose as a proof of principle fluorescein as a small molecule. So it's convenient because it's fluorescent when it's bound, and you can just see it bound to the to the protein antibody, and that's often used as a hapten or an antigen. And they could measure the binding of fluorescein bias fluorescence on the protein, and they can measure the KDs by competing it with free fluorescein. So they DNA shuffled their old library that we talked about last time, and for four cycles. That is, they shuffled, and then they selected. And the way they selected was they put their fluorescein with the yeast, and then they took away the fluorescein and they washed the yeast, right? And then they washed a few more times over several days, all the way up to 5 days. At the beginning, it was maybe only one day. Then they took all those out, and they took out all the antibody molecules and the antibody cDNAs, and then they hit them with DNAs, and they reshuffled them, and they reselected. This time they washed for longer, and then longer and longer. And what they achieved finally was, in fact, about 1,000 times better than the best antibody, or even 10,000 times better, well, about 1,000 times better. And it even had a slower off rate than biotin streptavidin. Mostly we use in the lab streptavidin, not avidin, because the streptavidin doesn't bind as tightly. It binds very tightly, but not as tight as the avidin. The avidin is sort of problematic because it binds so tightly. So here's a summary of their results in the different cycles, first, second, third, and fourth. And it's compared to some other very tightly binding proteins. So here's avidin biotin, and here's streptavidin biotin. It's about 100-fold less tight. Colicin is an E. coli protein. And barnase is an RNase. Right? So their off rate in their best genes that they ended up with was 2 times 10 to the minus 6 per second. That is only 2 in a million molecules in a whole second come off. And that translates into a 5-day half-life. So the DNA shuffling seems to be good. Now we can spread out a little bit horizontally and look for, still sticking with antibodies, but look at characteristics other than actually antigen binding. There might be other characteristics that would make an improved antibody. So, for example, in this case, they combined a single chain monoclonal antibody, they used DNA shuffling, and they used ribosome display so that they could look at a really large number of molecules, take the molecules. And they did their selection in the presence of a disulfide bond reducing agent, like mercaptoethanol, except better, diethyl-3-etol, or DTT. So many antibodies may need, some antibodies may need, in order to fold, the formation of these disulfide bonds, not necessarily between the chains, but even within the chains. So they selected for molecules that could fold without making any disulfide bonds, because disulfide bonds were constantly being reduced. And they got them. And they simultaneously selected for high ligand affinity. They didn't want to lose their binding affinity at the same time, and they could put that double selection on. So that's thinking a little bit outside the box. You can go beyond antibodies and look for enzyme evolution. So here's a protease inhibitor. And they wanted to, which was inherently sort of unstable when they used it. So, missing this one, 14? Missing a page? Oh, 5, 6, 7, 8 on the original ones. If you subtract the dendrion ones, they've been reordered because of dendrion, so they don't correspond to your numbers here. We're missing a page, yes. So you'll have to print that page from downloading the... Sorry about that. Unless it's going to show up later. I don't see it. So by selecting for enzyme stabilization and DNA shuffling, they got a couple of hundredfold increase in stability. So instead of the hours, now the enzyme was stable for days. So if you're using that enzyme to treat a patient, then it's going to last longer. Of course, you have a clearance also to worry about. But this application had a kind of a nice little final step. They found that their very stable enzyme, which was this TPA, which we met earlier in the Rice paper, right, is an activator of the protease, and this is an inhibitor of that protease. Of that TPA activation. So it would be anti-clotting. It would be sort of if you're doing a lot of bleeding, you might want to be able to add this. So you stop the TPA, which is busting the clots and maybe busting some good clots that are keeping you from bleeding to death. So they did what's essentially genetically a back cross. They took the best clone and they shuffled it back to the wild type sequence. So now, the only thing that the progeny of this shuffling are going to be are those that have less of mutations, because they're always putting in a certain amount of wild-type sequence. And then when they looked among the things that they got, they found that, in one sense, 9 of those amino acid changes were necessary to give this stability, and 2 of them didn't matter. Right? So you get if these two were, say, compromising, its activity as an inhibitor a little bit, then you wouldn't need to include them. Here's a fifth example. This is maybe a little bit similar to the interleukin, in that it's looking for differences in species sensitivities. So murine leukemia virus, which could be used as a vector maybe, has very poor infection on CHO cells. Murine, it infects mouse cells, but not CHO cells. And there's 6 different strains of murine leukemia virus that are genetically different, and none of them can infect CHO cells. So they just shuffled among these 6 strains their DNA sequence, and they got a new virus that now can infect CHO cells. So what was kind of interesting about this is that at the same time, they noticed that the preparation of the virus worked a lot better because the virus is sensitive to laboratory manipulations like centrifugation. And while they were preparing it, they were sort of at the same time selecting for those that could come through the centrifugation with greater viability without intending it necessarily. Right? And so they got it, it was 100 times more resistant. So sometimes you're selecting for something you don't even realize is going on. Now, we get to a more dramatic case in a way. DNA shuffling at the genomic level, the whole genome, instead of one gene. So here, this has been applied to bacteria. So there's a streptomycin species that's used in the industrial production of tylosin. This is tylosin. Look, very complicated. Look at that ring structure. Very complicated organic molecule that's an antibiotic, mostly used in animals. It's a veterinary use. So what they did was... it's not shown here, but it will show up, I guess, later, but I should introduce it right now, is that they mutagenized these cells. So you can imagine this is a long, probably a long biosynthetic pathway to make tylosin and secrete it. They wanted, and they're making it, and it's costing them a certain amount of money to make it, and they wanted to make it more efficiently. So they're looking for genetic variants, you know what you call them, recombinants, or mutants of the of this streptomycin species that can produce more tylosin more quickly. So they mutagenized a culture and heavily, and then they collected only 22,000 survivors. These are bacteria, so that's kind of a small number, but this is a small number in terms of what you usually have in survival, usually millions out of hundreds of millions. Because they're going to test each one of these 22,000. They didn't want any more than 22,000. So they screened all 22,000, grew them up in little wells, many multi-well dishes. This was their big labor investment. And they looked at how much tylosin they were producing. They naturally make this tylosin. But they had mutagenized it. So there's a range. Many of them were making less tylosin maybe than the wild type. But some were making more. So they picked the top 11. Then they digested away the coat using lysozyme, the cell wall of the bacteria, leaving just a membrane, like a mammalian cell. Then these membrane-bound bacteria, which are essentially spherical, if you mix them together and you add some reagent, like polyethylene glycol, just as we saw for animal cells, they will fuse. But the nice thing about the bacterial fusion is that the fused cells, which are now essentially diploid, will go when they go through a sporulation process, which is natural for them. They only in the spore they only put in a haploid amount of DNA, so they are just picking a haploid amount out of the diploid amount. So you get haploid spores, and then you have this new arrangement of maybe enzyme A or enzyme C and enzyme Z that are involved in this biosynthetic pathway, each with its own mutation, perhaps. So then these spores then regenerate a real cell with its real cell wall, and they're fine. So they took these top 11, they protoplast fused them all to each other, and collected 100 progeny from the sporulation. And they screened 100 of these and took the best 7. And they did the whole process again. They collected 100 of these progeny and they screened again 100. They got the best 9-fold. Now, 9-fold doesn't sound like some of the numbers we've been talking about, like 245-fold, but 9-fold is like almost 10 times as much tylosin for their same factories being produced, and they could use their factory for something else 10 months out of the year, right? Or cost them less, right? So this is the only example I've seen of shuffling whole genomes. It's a small genome, it's a bacteria still. The idea is there. And the biggest part of the work was screening those 22,000. We have robots, not so bad. Okay, so our final example is something sort of different. Again, this guy, Stemmer, who was the DNA shuffling guy, right? Now he said, why should we restrict ourselves? We're making therapeutic proteins for binding specific ligands at high affinity. Why should we restrict ourselves to antibodies? Sure, antibodies are a natural choice, but is it the only kind of biological molecule that can bind very specifically and very tightly to other molecules? No, think of all the receptors that are out there on the cell surface. Hundreds of different receptors, some with very high affinities. So they published this paper about, 6 years ago? On what he called exon shuffling, but for the life of me, I don't know why he called it an exon. An exon's a piece of DNA or RNA that could correspond to a domain, often could be corresponds to a domain, but often does not correspond to a domain. And from reading the paper, he's really talking about domains, domain shuffling. And they're going to make combinations of domains from different receptors that are selected for affinity for their target of interest. So they have like hundreds of known binding domains, and they're mutating them and then combining them. So there's like two levels of variation. One, they're sprinkling mutations in the right place in these receptor domains, and then they're putting together more complex proteins that have more than one of these domains. I'll talk about this in some detail. Here's a generalized picture of receptor structures. Not so easy to figure out from this, because what looks like the big blue things that look prominent visually are the uninteresting parts. The interesting parts are these A domains, which this is now the extension. You can see the receptor is on the outside of the cell. Here's the cell membrane and the transmembrane part and the cytoplasmic part. So this part that's sticking on the outside has these green regions, which are generally just 35 to 40 amino acids. And they have in this B part of this picture a cartoon of the structure. So there are certain, if you look at all at hundreds of different receptor domains of this type, which is the common type, you find certain conserved characteristics, which are three cysteine-cysteine disulfide bonds holding this domain together. Then there's four amino acids that are chelating a calcium ion, and these are the yellow ones here. I forget what they are. I think they're histidines and cysteines, maybe. And then there's just a couple of other conserved amino acids, these blue ones, whose role is not clear. And the rest are variable, although not, you know, there's not equal chance of all antibodies, just as we saw in the of any amino acid, just as we saw in the mutations of the hypervariable region we saw in that phage library. When they went in and made changes, now they're making changes not randomly, but in a directed way. Certain probability of putting a tyrosine and never a tryptophan, because you never see a tryptophan, things like this. So they're simulating, they're going to simulate, this is what they're going to mutate, the green ones, and they're going to simulate the natural occurrence of amino acids and not every old amino acid there. So they start with just making one domain. First, they give some examples here of how different the domains are in terms of binding. So here's like two domains that cooperate in order to bind alpha-2 macroglobulin. Here's a domain that's sort of the opposite. The same domain can use different parts of itself to bind two different molecules. If it's a small molecule, I'm not sure. And then even using the same domain in the same place, it's capable of binding two different kinds of molecules, I guess, in a slightly different way. so they used synthetic DNA, and it's not that big. If 40 amino acids would be 120 bases, which is a long synthetic oligomer, but you can do that. They kept the conserved parts the same, these yellow and blue and red amino acids. And they made a phage library. I quoted these numbers last time. I think I was thinking of this experiment, actually, where the complexity, when they figured out all their chances of having different amino acids at different positions, because there's still maybe 10 different amino acids in any position, was 10 to the 23rd, and they actually were able to screen, according to their calculation, 10 to the 10th as for phage display. So their first target was interleukin 6, because interleukin 6 is already a target in certain lymphomas. It's produced by immunocytes, and in case of inflammation, if you use anti-interleukin 6, you can combat inflammation that's mediated by immunocytes that are either producing or reacting to interleukin 6. So from the first, this first domain that they put in, and the first phage library they made, they panned and selected for tight binding and took the top 20 binders of interleukin 6 in their 10 to the 10th phage. So that's down here. That's the first step here. Here's the phage, this blue, long blue filament here, and there it is displayed on the tip. And there's what they call the monomer, that is a single domain. And there it is binding interleukin 6 in this model. I'm sure they don't have a structure. So this is after the screen. They can detach it and reclone it and test it for binding. And now they took their top 20. For each of the 20, they took their original library, which had all these mutated degenerate domains, and they attached it to the first one. So now they have two in a row with a little spacer in between. Right? And then they subjected they produced phage like that, and again selected for the 20 experiments with each of the top 20, now added to with the entire library, and they panned to select for the best ones. And again, they picked the best 20. So now again they have 20. And again they took the whole library and attached it to the dimer now. So they have 20 different pools, and then looked at all of those, and after the third cycle, they picked their tightest binder. That's C326. So they've ended up here with three domains with little spacers in between. And now they're going to characterize this protein. Before they went further, they added a protein sequence, or the DNA for a protein sequence that would bind IgG. So it's like protein A from bacteria that bind protein. I don't know where they got it exactly. And their idea was they want to make sure this doesn't compromise the activity of the rest of the protein. And this is going to give them much greater lifetime in the bloodstream, because the IgG is big, and it's going to be bound to this. Right? And they actually tested this and got about 90-hour half-life in monkeys. So their structure looks something like this. Here's the IgG binding domain, and there's their three selected domains, and there's the IL-6. So the way they tested for affinity, so we've talked about different ways. You've read about, like, ELISA a little bit. I haven't talked about it in lecture very much. A little bit. And that type of assay, for instance, used in the Rice paper, we've talked a lot about surface plasmon resonance, or the BioCore instrument, which seems to be giving you the best numbers. And here's another method called AlphaScreen. And so we'll introduce this so you're familiar with it. So this is kind of ingenious. You can buy these beads, which have the property that if excited at a particular wavelength by a laser, they'll produce reactive oxygen species. That's a property of this blue bead. Reactive oxygen species are like free radicals, and they have a very short half-life. So as soon as they start to diffuse away from this bead, they're gone in a very short time. So they don't get very far as active species. Now, the partner bead to this is one that when it is exposed to reactive oxygen species, there's a luminescence reaction that is promoted. So they become fluorescent. And except they're not fluorescent in the sense they're not absorbing light, they're being chemically activated to produce luminescence. So if these two beads are next to each other, then when you excite the blue one with the laser, you get luminescence from the yellow one. But they're not connected to each other. So you put things on which will connect them, like, in this case, IL-6. So this is, for instance, they sell it with like IgG on the surface, one of theirs, and the others would have avidin on the surface. And the IL-6 receptor then, where the IL-6 is going to do its job, is connected to the yellow bead, probably by biotinylating it. Right? And these are floating around. You hit the blue ones with this laser, which is hitting many of them, and nothing happens because they're not connected until they bump into each other. And if this receptor, which is what they built, as well as the natural receptor, right, connects the two, then we go back to this left-hand picture and you get the luminescence. So they look at that luminescence with the natural IL-6 receptor, and then they do a competition assay with their receptor. So if they compete just with IL-6 itself, then that's not biotinylated, so can't get attached to the bead. You get a half concentration of about one nanomolar here. So. But their C26 avomer is what they're calling it for avidity, right? Their avomer is shifted to the left. That is, it's effective at 10 times lower concentration. So it looks like they have produced a better receptor. But what was then they went back and looked at their proteins that they had isolated at various times. So their three. C326 has a particular monomer domain 1, 2, and 3. And if they just took the monomer 1 and did this assay, they get essentially no or very little competition effectiveness. And the same with M3. With M2, they do at very high concentrations, well, 1 micromolar, right, for M2. So I wonder, in fact, how are they able to select for M1, since that came out of their first screen as one of the top 20? Right? So they don't discuss that. But if they put them together in various combinations, then M2 plus M3 is somewhat better. M1 plus M2 is very much better. And all three is the best of all, giving a 20 picomolar dissociation constant. They also used BioCore. It's funny, the different methods they used gave different values. So this is now 253 picomolar, whereas this other one was 20 picomolar. It's about a tenfold difference, depending on the assay. Then they did a biological assay. They looked for the stimulation of an erythroleukemia cell line that's in a quiescent state, and then if you treat it with interleukin, it gets stimulated to grow, which you measure by quantifying DNA synthesis using radioactive DNA precursor, tritiated thymidine. And then if they add their Avomer, then they should be blocking this stimulation. So the stimulation starts out, you know, at like 8,000 here, and then goes down with the 326. The red curve is the most effective, and this is even lower. This half concentration for half effectiveness is about 1 picomolar, which is similar actually to an antibody that had been isolated. So they're a little bit better than even presumably the best antibody they could find, commercial antibody, and quite a bit better than another commercial antibody. So they are producing tight ligand binding, potentially useful therapeutics. They used 5 different targets in this initial work, in addition to IL-6, some other surface proteins, CD40, CD28, some other targets I'm not familiar with, and they got sort of comparable affinities in the same range. The C26 actually was the best here. But still, sub-nanomolar affinities. And finally, they tested in an intact animal the effectiveness. So if you inject IL-6 into a mouse, you can, enough of it, you can get this acute inflammatory response, which you can measure by measuring some amyloid protein that's produced. So if you put in human interleukin 6, you see this big jump compared to the control in this amyloid signal. And that's, if you just look at the ones I circled here. And if, in addition to the IL-6, you add this 326 interleukin binder, then you drive it down even below the control levels, or equivalent to the control levels. And if they use interleukin 1 to stimulate this acute response rather than interleukin 6, then their Avomer does nothing, as you would expect if it's specific for IL-6. So Stemmer made a new company out of this, Avomer, I forget the name, and that was bought by Amgen, so a big company, a few years ago. But I haven't seen products yet. Okay, so I'm going to start now a new subject, and this will continue into next time. And that'll be focusing on RNA for therapeutic use. RNA is a target for therapies. And if we have time, we'll see. We might get into siRNA, which is really a separate kind of strategy. So most of the few papers that show encouraging results using RNA as the target have focused on RNA splicing, pre-mRNA splicing for that RNA. If they want to shut down or change a deleterious protein, as we'll see. So before we can talk about splicing, I'll give you a quick course in RNA splicing. So in splicing, you have to remove an intron from between two exons, right? And the ends are called from left to right, the 5' splice site here and the 3' splice site further downstream. You have to do this with great precision. If you're one base off and you connect those two exons, then you have shifted the reading frame and you make garbage. So it has to be very reproducible and precise. In addition, in general, you have to connect exon 1 to exon 2 to exon 3 so that the protein has all the information it has and you don't skip anything. So you don't get this skipping. There's an orderliness to splicing. Now there's a giant exception to that rule, which is called alternative splicing, in which you purposely skip some fraction of the time an exon or splice it at a different 5' or 3' site to make a slightly different exon. That is usually in frame. And so you make two different proteins from the same gene. And this is very important because it enables us to make many more proteins than we have genes for. And it's thought to underline our complexity. Who knows? I mean, complexity of mice compared to nematodes, which have similar number of genes. But the majority of the exon, and almost every gene, is documented to undergo some alternative splicing, gene product, some time, somewhere, by someone. And this is only getting worse as our depth of our deep sequencing gets more and more sensitive. And we just keep looking, we find these variants, these isoforms that represent alternative splicing. So one question that comes up is if you have a little bit of alternative splicing in one tissue at one time, is it physiologically significant or not? Many times it is, even if it shifts the reading frame so that now there's a nonsense mutation pops up right away. That's thought to, and in a few cases been shown to, be a physiological way of shutting down that gene expression rather than going through the transcriptional control. Maybe it's faster. So you just skip an exon, and so you just make garbage. And you want to make garbage because you have to respond quickly, perhaps. But maybe what percentage of those alternative splices are of this type that are physiologically significant? Nobody knows. Still, since genes have many exons, even if every gene undergoes really physiologically significant splicing at some point in development in some tissue, nevertheless, the majority of the exons are constitutively spliced. They're spliced the same way every time. I'd say 85%, because there's about 8 or 9 exons per gene. So splicing goes through two stages. In the first stage, the 5' splice site attacks this branch point, which is about 25 bases upstream of the 3' splice site, but it could be, it varies, could be most of them within 18 to 40. Some of them are 200 bases in some cases. So that moves around a little bit, but the average is minus 24 here. And now this exon is not floating free, but is still part of this giant complex that catalyzes this reaction known as the spliceosome. So then the second step is that this 3' hydroxyl that's left on this exon 1 attacks the 3' splice site, and the two exons are connected, and this lariat structure, which is temporarily made up here, is released and quickly degraded. In vitro, and it's thought to be also true in vivo, some evidence it's also true in vivo, is that the pre-mRNA assembles the spliceosome right on the substrate. There's a few people who think it's pre-assembled and then goes there, but it doesn't seem to be widely accepted. And so are there these 5 different ribonucleoprotein particles, the U1 small nuclear RNPs, or SNRPs, they're called. It binds to the 5' end. There's some, this is facilitated by some complementarity between a small RNA that's part of the U1 particle and the 5' splice site. But you can sometimes get it to go even without that. But in most cases, the better the complementarity of your 5' splice site is to the 5' end of this U1 small nuclear RNA that's in this particle, the stronger your splice site is. And then U2, another particle, binds to the branch point. And again, there's complementarity between the RNA it carries and the branch point sequence. Here it's less compelling. The branch point sequence is very degenerate. Even the 5' splice site is degenerate. There's some, you'll see it in a minute. After these two bind, then 3 more particles as a ternary complex come in, and you get this pentamer, and that's the active spliceosome. Each one's got a small RNA that's distinct, and then there's a gazillion proteins. I don't know. Nobody knows exactly, but a couple of hundred probably proteins. So it's bigger than the ribosome, which has about 80 proteins. Then you have an energy-related change in conformation. U1 and U4 leave. You get the complex of just this 3, and that conducts the splicing. And as I say, the lariat then with the spliceosomal factors is then degraded. In terms of the information, for binding, the 5' splice site here in purple, that's the consensus sequence, but only the GU, we often say GT, at the first two bases are pretty much 99.5% conserved. There's a few oddball ones. But these others, R means purine, either one. These others are not. It could be only like 75% or 60% U here instead of 25%, which would be totally random. Similarly, the 3' splice site, Y is a pyrimidine, C or T. You have and the length of this is not fixed. Could be usually at least 10, but could be 20. The only thing that's definitely conserved is the AG. So this GT and AG are completely conserved. And then there's some bases also right in the exon here that are also conserved, although not completely conserved, but from splice site to splice site. And then there's the branch point out here, which has this loose consensus. It's not quite sure what it is. And that's, you can see there's Y's and R's. And even with the Y's and R's, there are still plenty of branch points that don't conform to this. They have to have this A, because that's where the attachment is, at the fifth, one, two, three, four, sixth position. And that's actually always there. Here's to scale the sequence of the human HPRT gene. Remember that from the salvage pathway? So in red, you have the exons. And somehow the cell is able to see these exons, and even with their degenerate site. So this remains a mystery and is one of the main focuses of my lab, to find out how the cell does that. Alternative splicing dimension can be complete skipping, which is the simplest, but you can also use alternative 5' splice sites so that you can make a longer or shorter form of this central exon. Alternative 3' splice sites, you have longer or shorter form of the terminal exon here. Or you can put in an exon that has a poly-A site in it, so you get a truncated protein. And those are used a lot to make shorter versions of your proteins. So one main use of this alternative splicing is to make different proteins with different functions. Sometimes these, since you have two different proteins, this one's got a big domain in the middle and the other's got a little domain in the middle. And they could have similar functions, like there's a whole bunch of different troponins which help send signals, accept signals for muscle contraction. And they might be different in the heart than skeletal muscle or in smooth muscle. So you make different troponins, and to a large extent that's controlled by differential splicing so that the troponins are different. Sensitive to different concentrations of calcium and work with different kinetics in terms of the contraction. So that's a way of doing variations on a theme. Tropomyosin, okay. Troponin is true for troponin too. Tropomyosin is another case like that. So you can see you have these different combinations, these different differentiated cells. So it's thought alternative splicing underlies a lot of differentiation. And perhaps now we're not talking about is the differential polyadenylation making different messages, which is sort of analogous to this. How do you find the polyadenylation sites? You have the same kind of problem, is that you see plenty of signals that are there and they're not used, similar to transcription. Also, you have that situation. But in the case of polyadenylation, you can make a molecule with a long 3' untranslated region or a short one. The long ones generally are sensitive to degradation triggered by microRNAs. So if you want to stabilize your message, you short it, you polyadenylate it early. What controls that? Here's the world's champion alternative splicer, the DSCAM gene in Drosophila melanogaster. This is a gene that has a couple of functions, but one function is thought to be axonal guidance during development of the fly's nervous system. So you'd think, I mean, who knows how that's done, how you get all these different connections. So maybe it's alternative splicing, because in this gene, you have groups of exons. Here's exon 4, exon 5, exon 6, etc. So exon 5 is unique, and it's always included. But exon 4, you have what? About 12 different possibilities. And you, once you splice one in, you don't splice any other from this group in. So it's 3. There's one of these 4s, then 5. And then you have your choice of any one of these 6s. There's 38 different ones. And then you have a 7 and 8, which are constant. Exon 9 has 33 possibilities. Exon 17 has 2 possibilities. And if you multiply all these numbers and say, how many combinations could you make, you get, with these mutually exclusive splicings, this is a big gene. Not that big. With 115 exons total, 38,000 combinations. So you can say, well, okay, it's 38,000 combinations, but not necessarily all being equal. Maybe some of them are only put together in certain ways. You end up with only 100 combinations. But so far, enough different ones have been found, messenger RNAs have been found, so that the idea that all 38,000 are being used somewhere, sometime, has not been eliminated. And it's certainly in the thousands, the ones that have been isolated. So it boggles the mind. I talked about this. A lot of human disease is caused by splicing. Right now it's about 15% for genetic, for human inherited diseases. It's a big target. In our own lab, many years ago, we mutated a gene randomly and saw and asked what kind of mutations we got. A third of them were splicing mutants. We selected for loss of function. A third of them were nonsense mutants, a third of them were missense mutants, roughly, and a third of them were splicing mutants. So it's a big target, functional target, splicing. As I say, in human disease, 15%, and I think that number could go up. Usually, you lose an exon. You knock out its ability to be spliced, and usually you knock out the splice site. But sometimes you knock out other information which is necessary to specify that that's a splice site, which we're not sure of that information yet. Sometimes you activate, you create an exon out of a non-exon, something that's almost an exon but is never used, and then you mutate it with GA, say, and you mutate it to GT, and now it has everything else. It didn't worry about it before because it didn't have a GT, it only had GA, it was never included, and now it's included and it screws up the protein. So the way that therapy is going to target this is very straightforward in a sense. You're going to target some objectionable splicing by using an antisense. It's not siRNA. This is an antisense, single-stranded RNA or DNA or some plastic RNA that can base pair specifically to that sequence and inhibit splicing and therefore do a good thing. So we'll talk about those good things next time.